Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Another thing that I really like that I heard you say in another one of your videos was somebody asked you just about the whole unschooling enterprise. How much time does this take? I think was the question. And the answer was something like, it takes all the time and none of the time.
Pam Cerici and I were both there, and I think she said none. How much time do you have to spend every day on this? She said none. I said all. And that's what it is. You change your life. You change the way you see and believe and interact.
But it's also, with respect to deschooling, it's the contrast between the expectations that people might bring versus what natural learning is, right? If you're asking me about natural learning, I might say, then yeah, it's all of your time. If you're talking to me about schooling and your schooling-related expectations or your schooled expectations, then it's none of your time. That's
exactly.
Over.
That's it. That's it. When we talk about choices, too, and people are coming into the new discussion, they go, well, you have to do this, or I had to do that. I stop them, and I give them a link to my page on have to. Satterdod.com/have to. If you feel like you have to do something, you've just made yourself powerless unnecessarily. Don't do that. For one thing, you don't move from that imagined have to.
Right.
You get in the habit of saying have to, you're going to pass it around. You're going to tell your kids what they have to do too. And if they don't have a choice, they can't make a choice. And when people say, well, he chose to be an Olympic swimmer when he was seven. It's like no kid ever chose to be an Olympic swimmer when he was seven. But some people will come up with something like that. Well, he said he wants to be a pilot. She said she's interested in this. Okay, let that interest last for about a minute or a lifetime, but don't own it. Don't take it over. And if the parents say, I want to unschool and I want to do it and I'm never going to change my mind, that's not as healthy as saying, I'm going to try this in a while. If you're going to have a good relationship with another person, with your partner, with your child, with the neighbors, with the other unschoolers, you need to choose over and over and over as often as you can. One conscious choice to be a kind parent forever isn't going to get you past the next morning. You're going to get tired and irritated. But if every time you start to do something, you try to remember that you do have a choice, you don't have to do this, then the choices can ratchet up gradually to a place that you never knew you could even get to, as to patience and understanding and an acceptance of how learning works. But it does, you can't jump 15 steps all at once. You have to walk there yourself. So you might start with choices that sound horrible, like I could send them to school or I could buy a curriculum. Okay, well, buy the curriculum. That doesn't mean you have to use it. Just because you bought a curriculum doesn't mean that you're obligated to do 180 days of school at home at the table.
Right.
So if people make choices all along, then they can walk away from the things that were harmful to them as children or that might be harmful to their children now. They can walk one step at a time towards something better as they gradually, from read a little, try a little, wait a while, watch, start to see what does seem to them better.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Friday, November 9th, and I'm very pleased to be welcoming a long overdue guest, somebody who is a world-renowned advocate for unschooling and natural learning, Sandra Dodge. She's the author of Sandra Dodge's Big Book of Unschooling, and her website, sandradodge.com, that's D-O-D-D, is one of the most comprehensive resources that you are going to find on the topic of unschooling on the entire internet, and that is a very big place. But Sandra's been doing this work for a long time. She's the mother of three adult children who never attended school. We're going to talk about that in the show today. So this conversation actually went in a couple unexpected directions, but I'm very, very happy that it did. First of all, I want to say that I was a little bit nervous going into this. I had never talked to Sandra before, and she expressed some concern in our preliminary email discussions about our presentation, the name of our project, and we're going to talk about that in the conversation today. And I found her explanation so thought-provoking and persuasive that I almost named the show Stop Telling Young People That School Sucks. But that was a little bit too narrow a focus. It was only a small part of our conversation. The title, Unschooling in Choice, is a much broader capture of everything we talked about. So there was some initial apprehension, and some of you might be saying, Brett, you talk a lot about things making you nervous lately. Maybe you need to cut down on your caffeine intake. I appreciate your concern, but I would like to remind you that every time I talk about one of these nerve-wracking propositions, there is always some success on the other side of it, and today's show is no exception. That reminds me, if you're interested in hearing the speech that I did on the Contra Cruise on my communication successes and failures, it is available on Patreon, or for our AV Club supporters, you can go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV to get access to that and so much more, including the personal development theme show that I do with my good friend and neighbor, Andrew. It's called The Discomfort Zone. That is back up and running now that I'm done with my travels. The fourth installment was our most uncomfortable conversation yet, but also probably the most productive and important. See this theme? See how this works? So Sandra and I are going to talk a little bit about our background. One thing that I was particularly interested in is, even though we've arrived at our unschooling advocacy through different paths, as we all do, there was some overlap in a couple of areas that I wanted to explore. Sandra was a former teacher. She taught in public school for about 6 years. I wanted to know, number one, why she left and how and why she made the transition into unschooling for all three of her children. So that will be a big portion of our discussion. We're going to talk about the process of young people learning to read. And I know that's something that a lot of parents in the audience have concerns about. So that thread will run through a good portion of this conversation. We will also talk about Sandra's influences, including John Holt, the experiments in the open classroom concept in the 1960s and the 1970s, and what it was like. I think her three children were born between 1986 and 1991. So we'll talk about the early days of trying to navigate home learning and trying to make connections with others. And of course, her unschooling philosophy, a big part of this conversation as well. So that's it, everybody. Today's show clearly geared more towards parents or people planning to be parents. And I'm very, very proud to now be able to add Sandra Dodd to our list of guests on the topic of unschooling. So I will talk to you more next week. I'll be teaming up with Richard Grove and Professor CJ for something special. You'll learn more about that soon. In the meantime, enjoy your weekend. Thank you for listening and take care. Sandra, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So you're in New Mexico, correct?
Correct. Albuquerque.
Albuquerque. Oh, I was just there at this time last year. I was actually visiting with an unschooling family outside of Albuquerque, and I'm in Pittsburgh. We had our first frost today, so definitely appreciating New Mexico.
I grew up north of here, and my husband grew up south, so we had it covered as to friends and relatives at various places.
You know, I was thinking about these people lived in kind of a remote location. It wasn't too far away from the city, but it was out there a little ways. And they're, you know, they have a young daughter and they're trying to navigate the unschooling world and make connections in a fairly remote location. And I think about your story and you trying to do this. You have children that were born between the mid-1980s and the early 1990s, three children who are now adults. What was that like, you know, in the dawn of the information age, trying to find resources or make connections with like-minded people?
Well, even then, some people were better at it than others. Some people just didn't have the connections to know what was available. But John Holt had died just before I had my first child. I had read some of his stuff in college. Interestingly, they made me read it, and that's fun. Mm-hmm. But there was a magazine that he had started that was still going, so I subscribed to that. It came every other month, and I'd read every word. It was sort of a question-answer format, so it was a little bit like a bulletin board only arranged. And I had done a magazine like that too myself, a philosophy based on a medieval studies club I was in. So I understood the format really well. Everybody writes in, and then you put the best answers back out. Mm-hmm. And it was helpful, but it wasn't constant. And it was a random arrangement, if you needed questions, if you were hoping for questions about younger kids, it might be all about teens, one issue, but that's all right. It was good. And then there, people would meet up and talk and share what they had. And there were a few books, Teach Your Own, mm-hmm. which John Holt wrote near the end there. He wrote another couple of books after that. But it was good to have those. And I had gone to the university to study. I wanted to be a teacher, but I did not study education because there was a prejudice against doing that. I studied English and psychology. And in the dark when no one was looking, took education classes.
What was the prejudice?
That only girls who weren't very smart studied education.
Oh, I gotcha. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, early 70s.
Sure. So you encounter through this experience the work of John Holt. I'd be interested in hearing a little bit about his influence on you and what it was that he said in his work that really resonated with you.
I can't name all of the people, but there were several school reform writers around that we were reading in the 70s. And also at the University of New Mexico, there were a couple of professors who had written a book called The Open Classroom. Mm-hmm. And so because they were there at the university where I was in Albuquerque, they had a lot of influence locally. And there were schools built in Albuquerque on that model, on the wouldn't it be nice if open classroom school. And I think there are three elementaries and a mid school. I'm not sure really what still exists, but what happened was, I'm kind of going on tangent. Sorry.
Go on tangents, please. We love tangents.
What happened? I wasn't involved in that because I finished my degree and went back to my hometown, Espanola, which is north of Santa Fe, to teach where I had gone to school, which was a huge education in itself because I was teaching with people who had been my teachers. Mm-hmm. It was a great, great lab for learning about teaching. But I had wanted to be a teacher since I was little, so I paid a lot of attention to this. I'd always said to all my friends, I'm going to be a teacher. My other choices were, my other little fantasies were, you know, backup plans were, maybe I'll be a journalist or maybe I'll be a nun. Only I was Baptist, so that wasn't going to work out. So as it turns out, looking back, it seems that journalist missionary, you know, it wasn't a nun, it was a missionary actually that I mostly talked about, but I had this religious thought, you know, of helping people, mm-hmm. helping people who couldn't get other help. So now here I am kind of like a missionary for unschooling, for education through writing. So I rolled it all together.
Indeed,
but the open
yeah.
classroom, the open classroom buildings have a big open area that they use for cafeteria or PE or lunch. And then off of that in sort of pie wedge shapes are these other classrooms that were supposed to be the learning centers. There would have been one for history and one for science, one for reading and all like that. But as soon as there's no choice, the research in the late 60s and early 70s worked really well because the participants were self-chosen. It was the children of education professors or the kids of people who were studying at that university. And they knew that they were in an experimental school. And they were into it. The parents thought this would be great. The kids thought this is fun. This is more fun than regular school. And so the results they got were good. Mm. And the research that they were doing was stuff like, what if kids aren't sorted and graded? What if the teachers don't have test scores on them? What if you let them choose when and how to study science? And they're studying from things that they touch and grow and feed instead of just looking at pictures and books. What if history is going to real places? You know, not the one field trip a year model that most schools have, but kind of live there where you bring people and things in and take the kids out to people and things, not just museums, but where people are making things, working, building.
Right.
And it sounds good and it can work. It can work if everybody is voluntary.
And there's buy-in. Yeah.
That makes it alive.
Right.
When everybody wants to be there. So they put it into the public schools and said, we've tested this, it works. And the teachers who were there, who were not getting paid very much, who maybe had been teaching already 15 or 20 years, they said, we're changing everything. And they said, that's not in my contract, bud.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that as a young teacher in my master's program when I think it was No Child Left Behind was being implemented. And just the you know, it's a different situation where, you know, you're trying to move this to a more, at that time that you're talking about, a more learner-centered model. And, you know, No Child Left Behind was about something else. But the change, like the perception of dramatic change, especially for people who had been there, you know, not veterans, but 4 or 5 years, that was so disruptive to them. So I could imagine something that's such a paradigm shift at that time, like in the 1970s, for somebody who already had a decade plus under their belts, that would be you know, a real struggle to try and adapt and to try and understand why they needed to adapt to something new.
And people who were veteran teachers or even slightly experienced teachers then had studied in the 40s and the 50s.
Mm, right.
And it was seen as a hippie thing. You know, now what are these hippies trying to make us do?
Right.
But it wasn't only the teachers who balked. It was the kids and the parents. Well, the parents, because the kids said, we don't have to. Have to was at the center of this thing. Have to has been at the center of a lot of what I've discovered and looked at and written about. I can come back to that in a minute. But
sure.
The kids said, I don't have to. I'm not going to. Because the only reason they had been doing anything in school is because they were threatened.
Mm-hmm.
So when the threat was lifted, then the kids just sort of went crazy. And the parents, meanwhile, are told, oh, they're changing everything. You're not going to have homework. And they say, well, how is he going to learn? How are you going to prove he's learning? Oh, we'll give you a report at the very end of the year. Well, how will I know he's not going to fail? Nobody's going to fail. Because the people who were promoting it had so much confidence because they had seen it work. They didn't know what would happen if you put it out into a place where you had just released all the rules and all of the strictures. It's like those rubber band airplanes that you wind and wind and wind and wind and wind.
Mm-hmm.
Or like a trebuchet. You know, the tighter you crank it, the further that's going to launch.
Yeah, when you let it go, of course. You know, people talk a lot about a sort of decompression. Like if a kid comes out of school and is in more of a natural learning or hands-off kind of environment, there's obviously going to need to be a period of decompression because all that boy or girl has known is the compulsion of school, the force, the threat, you know, is often a strong word, but it's certainly implicit and it's certainly consistent through the entire experience.
Right.
So the history here that we've been talking about is in the universities, and New Mexico is a bit of a hotbed for this while you're studying, experimentation and investigation of the open classroom concept of natural learning leads to the development of these laboratory schools where there's, you know, a lot of intrinsically motivated people both on the teaching side and on the learning side. And when this looks like a success, they try to pass it along to the public schools. And it fails because the public schools are based on compulsion. So as far as you know, is this like the end of this experiment in the public schools in the 1970s? Because I remember being in graduate school and they were still talking about this kind of education. It was interesting that a lot of my professors in graduate schools talked like people who worked at Sudbury schools. They had this sort of idealistic vision of what the public schools were going to be. And then I think when a lot of us started student teaching, we realized that a lot of these ideas were not insertable into that environment. But were the 70s, the attempted implementation of that, was that like the last the public school wanted to hear about these ideas as far as you know?
Well, I think it was the first they heard about it.
Right.
And pretty close to the last. I don't know generally in the whole world how it was. I mean, I can't imagine that there was a lot of open classroom stuff going on in Nebraska. I'm just making up a place. You know that, apologies to people from Nebraska if it was a hotbed of alternative ed.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some places where it worked better and longer because some individual was enthusiastic and a good leader. That's got to happen. That always happens. So if somebody had become an administrator or a principal or something and could get it to go for a while, I'm sure it went, because if I were to say, nope, that was the end, I don't know. But I visited some schools doing some demonstration sort of education things historical in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Late 80s? No. Around the early 80s. And the classrooms that we would go into that were in those open classroom buildings, the teachers had just sort of built walls between those areas with filing cabinets and bookshelves. So the buildings were irritating because there was no sound division. Mm.
Yeah.
The acoustics were terrible because they were made out of cinder block and concrete, and they were intended to have soft places to read and carpet and all that, right? But that just didn't last. So the building was built for a philosophy and a practice that hadn't taken. So not only were the people who were originally involved in it looking down on open classroom, but the people who had to live in those old open classroom houses were irritated too because it didn't work for individual classes. I do understand teachers not wanting to do weird stuff.
Right.
Because they are feeling that they're answerable too, that they're responsible to prove that they're teaching. And that open classroom stuff, the way it worked was near the end of the year, near the end of the semester, however they had decided in that group, in that class to do it. It would be like, also they would mix classes. It wouldn't be like one individual class. It would be like all the fourth graders or all of the first through third doing things in various groups. So if a kid hadn't touched the math curriculum and it's April, then they press him through May by playing games or getting him in there and playing with him. getting him to do it. So there was also still kind of a press and some pressure to have done all of the things, because some kids would, out of their own curiosity or their own sort of organizational personality, have done it all, but some were avoiding one until the end. And right. The teachers didn't know how to deal with that. I wouldn't know how to deal with it myself, because after being sweet to this kid, now you're going to bully him the last 2 weeks to get that credit. Yeah, it's hard.
Oh, the whole idea, is very difficult. I think about, we were both teachers, and, I think about my experience, reflecting on my experience. One of the things that really frustrated me is, obviously I felt a lot of pressure to be a good, finger quotes, good teacher, effective teacher. But so little of that pressure was coming from what students thought of me, and more of it was coming from the top down, what I was supposed to do in that role. So I'm agreeing with you that the implementation of something new where you're feeling a lot of uncertainty about what you're doing and why would be frustrating, confusing, and bring about some anxiety for me as a young teacher, and I eventually did take more of the natural learning approach in my classroom because I had no choice, just because it was so clear that doing the top-down conception of what a good, effective teacher managing behavior, managing a classroom environment, that did not work with the population of students that I taught, and I had to change things. But I totally understand the apprehension that most teachers would feel about that. Did you, when you were teaching and you taught middle school for what period of time?
6 years, 4 years in 7th grade and 2 years 9th grade.
Do you share
that? So for your international audience, sure. That's 12 and 13-year-olds for the 7th grade, and then 9th grade, they're 14 turning 15. Is that right? 15, 16,
yeah.
17, no, 15, 15 turning 16. Yeah, so they were all in that pubescent age. I liked it. That's the age I had wanted to teach. And when I went to my student teaching, I said, I'm going to teach junior high. And they said, we're going to put you in high school. It's easier. I said, but I need to learn how to do what I'm going to do. And they said, yeah, you're going to do high school. It's fine. So when I went in there, what I had from – I've been trying to think of how to answer your question about what maybe particularly I took from John Hull. But I took the general gist of there are things in school that prevent learning, mm-hmm. that discourage learning, that beat kids down and confuse them. And there are ways to tweak it so that that's not happening. And so I thought, okay, given the – structure and the stricture of they assign me these kids at these hours. How can I do my best to be creative with them? My advantage was I went back into a town and a district where I grew up. So I already had a reputation there for being pretty quick and creative mm-hmm. and not dishonest. So when I said, I'm going to do this and it's going to work, they all went, okay, because I had done things that worked before. I had designed a class when I was in high school and run that, and it was called History 69. So you know how old I am. Mm-hmm. But it was a current events class where the kids did presentations. And I had already primed a pump there for myself, and that's fine. But I didn't use the books. I was teaching English. I used a magazine that came out for that sort of thing, and we used dictionaries that we would do a math project to figure out how cheap can we get these dictionaries if we get them in bulk from Arrow Books or whatever it was, Book of the Month. I forget what it was, the little paper things that they would give you to order books in classrooms. We would manage to get them for about $1, $1.25, and then cover them with paper from wallpaper samples. And it was just like projects within projects. So everybody had their own dictionary, and we just keep them there. And we would do things about history of words, games with the dictionaries. To them, it seemed like games. And to me, I knew it was etymology and vocabulary and spelling and geography and history. And on every Friday, all those 6 years, every year, what I did was on Friday, I would say, on Friday, I'm only going to sing you a ballad. And that's all we're going to do on Fridays. And the first few years, I would write the words on the chalkboard and they would write them back down. They would copy them into a notebook. And that was because the kids were younger and it was, I don't know, handwriting or whatever. But later on, I started just giving them a handout. I've talked to people in the last year. My daughter met a woman who turns out had been in my class, and she started singing one of those songs to her. And people write to me sometimes and say, I still sing these songs. So they thought that that was nothing, that they were just, Friday was a day off. And I treated it that way. I was treated that way. They said, do we have to learn these? And I said, no, you don't have to learn anything on Friday. Mm. So not everybody can do that. Not everybody would want to do that. Not everybody knew enough ballads to last every Friday for a year. Right. But I did. So I used it. And so I knew when I was filling out my forms, my lesson plans and stuff, that was poetry and literature and vocabulary. But the kids didn't know. I never said it. And so having been told, you don't have to learn this, they learned them. They still know them.
So
some of them.
It sounds like you regard your public school teaching experience in a lot more a positive light than a lot of the former teachers that I talked to. And I guess that would be attributed to the fact that you were able to make it your own more than a lot of other people are able
well,
to.
Well, why did I quit after 6 years?
That was my next question. Yeah.
I had no way out of giving grades.
Right.
And it broke my heart to take a kid who was just not either had pressure from home, you know, really unhappy home life, or just wasn't yet with it. Because sometimes kids, I know a lot from unschooling, sometimes kids just can't read well at first. And they learn to read when they're older if it's not broken. If they could be allowed to wait till they were 12 or 13 to read, there are a lot of people who read at 12 or 13 if they're left alone. But in school, they've been given Fs and Fs and Fs in every other subject because they can't read well enough to do the assignment. And they're told, you are a non-reader. And they, after that, they don't even try. They come to see books and libraries and the written word as their enemy, as the thing they can never do, as the thing that made them a failure. And I was living in that, in those waters. And I didn't know then that kids could naturally learn to read, but I know now. So also there were parents. Parents irritated me. And behavioral issues irritated me. And administrators who had been promoted because they were really bad teachers, and the only way they could legally and easily get them out of the classroom was to make them an assistant principal in charge of basketballs. Only thing is, then after a while, they get promoted again.
Right. Yeah.
So that sort of thing was irritating to me. And I think probably it was mostly parents and grading that made me feel that I was contributing again to something negative. So I did the best I could, and I had fun, and I learned a lot. And so again, as a pattern of my life, is ever since first grade, I thought, I want to be a teacher. So what is it that they do? What's the thing that they do? Because it doesn't always show to kids.
Right,
like me
right.
talking about the ballads, you know, those kids never do what my secret plan was. You know what I was, it was fun for me too. It was fun for me to see them get excited about some weird thing I knew, some 300 or 400 year old song, and talk to them about it. But I started paying attention. I had a cousin my parents raised who was in the same grade as I was, and I saw us go through school together all those years and learn different things, and that was fun. And we would share what we learned later at the house. You know, we shared a bedroom for a long time, and she was learning Chaucer. I wasn't, and she knew a really cool verse about the planets, and she taught it to me, and there were things that I learned that I shared with her. And so I knew that two kids in the same house, in the same school, could have completely different experiences.
Sure.
When I went from 7th grade to 9th grade, I was standing outside my classroom in the hallway of this big school, just like picture any typical school. And there I was standing outside my room, and the kids are looking at their schedules. And some would look up and see me, and because that's what I was looking at. I'm looking at these kids to see them see me, because some of them would go, whoa, it's my name at the time was Gil. It's Gil, Miss Gil. And they would just be giddy, happy, hopping up and down because they had been in my class in 7th grade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then some would look up, do a double take, and just look like, oh, they were going to puke. So I thought, okay, now this is a normal, normal thing. It's just like somebody can really love her husband to pieces, but none of her friends would have had him, you know?
Yeah.
They're, on top of all else, a teacher's technique is not going to overcome personality.
Right.
And so some people love a certain personality and some don't. With unschooling writers and speakers, there are some that I collect other people's writings too on my site, so I know this well. Sometimes somebody just doesn't like my writing because I tell stories, I go on tangents, I get emotional, but they really like the writing of Joyce Federal or Pamela Rickia. And the trick that I know, that we know from the, you know, the teacher's lounge, as it were, those guys were engineers. They were both engineers.
Mm-hmm.
They're very methodical in how they present their information. And I bounce off the person who's asking me. And I kind of poke them a little bit to figure it out on their own. So the kind of interaction that I'm doing is probably kind of things I did when I was teaching too, which is a shame to say. But you know, if you can ask a question or say something that surprises them enough, that makes them think, that shakes up their thinking, that's better than just giving them the answer.
Can I ask you, was it frustrating at the time when, you know, you're standing outside that door and there's criticism always seems much louder than praise to me. And that was true when I was a teacher. It's true as a podcaster. But just thinking about those experiences of students who are really excited to see you and students who are visibly not excited to see you, I think it speaks to, you know, the unfortunate forge that school tries to be for, you know, all things to all people, where even a very conscious, involved, and invested teacher is just not going to be able to connect with certain students. But what was that like for you? I mean, how did you register that and process that when there's kids who are clearly not excited to see you again, when you feel like you're investing so much passion in what you're doing?
I knew all that since fourth grade, that there are, I loved my fourth grade teacher. Mm-hmm. She used to spank. Like, she kept put the names on the board of the people who had been bad. And at the end of the day, you had a choice of a spanking or to write lines.
Oh,
to,
wow.
You know, write something. And I loved her, and I would write lines and not get a spanking because I didn't mind writing. But some people hated her. They hated her at the time. And she was also their catechism teacher. And so some of them were really bugged to have to be in their catechism teacher's classroom. Mm-hmm. But I just thought she was the sweetest person. And she came to my house and met my parents, which was a little bit necessary because there was some oddity in my mom. And she and my cousins – teacher both came to our house. They were friends, and they just came and visited, sat around, drank coffee. But, you know, it was a home visitation. But I just thought she was wonderful. And I when my daughter was 9, the age I had been in her classroom, we went to a funeral in my hometown, and we went over and spent the rest of the day with her. Instead of going to the burial or the lunch or anything, we just went to her house. And I was, even though we were unschooling, she was my third kid unschooling, I was really happy to like take and introduce her to my fourth grade teacher and talk about when I was that age. So I was not an anti-school person. I was a realistic person, I think. But in fourth grade, because people didn't like Miss Gonzalez, I thought, okay, she's an angel, although she spanks the boys.
Right.
How could they not like her? And I saw that many other times after that. And so here I was teaching in the same school district and same buildings, both of those buildings that I taught in, I had been in for a long time. I saw kids in the classrooms of teachers that I had liked or not liked. I saw them like or not like. In various combinations. So it's a dyad. There's always that dyad between the teacher and the student. And there's no teacher that I've ever seen that everybody likes.
Right.
And there are no students that everybody hates, because there was another teacher of English, and she didn't like the boys after they were bigger, and I would trade her. If there was a kid who had no preference at all, you know, I didn't mind going to her class, or I would say, well, I'll take him, but you got to give me a piece of furniture. You know, it's just wheeling and dealing like that. Mm-hmm. But I knew then that there were people who didn't have a preference, who would say, oh, whatever, I don't care. And some who really had a preference among the teachers and the students. Mm. So that happens in all areas of life. Someone will really like a club or some resource store, and some won't. So if somebody doesn't like your podcast, I don't know, who knows what it might be.
I guess the difference is that in those other situations, people can easily escape it, right? Like, I'm not going to chase somebody.
They don't have to listen to your podcast. Right. Yeah, nobody's – and I've said that about unschooling sometimes when people complain about my discussion group. I say, was anyone court-ordered to be here? If not, you can leave. You know, there's not even a door. You just click a click. You're
right,
gone.
Right.
It's fine.
So you talk about not coming at this from an anti-school attitude, which is obviously a very common attitude for a lot of people who become, you know, advocates of unschooling. At least it's present. You have three adult children. None of them went to school at all, right? Even for a day. Is that correct?
Holly visited.
Yeah.
3 days. Yeah, but no, she wasn't enrolled.
Right. And she's your youngest. The two oldest, Kirby and Marty, are boys. So when Kirby was young, you were thinking, though, that you were going to send him to school. So can you talk a little bit about that transition in mindset from, sure, you know, preparing Kirby to go to school, maybe age 4, age 5, and the path? I know it's a long path and there's lots of detail in it, but you can tell it however you want the story.
I can tell an important aspect of it.
Sure, sure.
New Mexico, when I was a kid, didn't have compulsory kindergarten. It was just, yeah, if you want to pay for kindergarten, do it. But the schools weren't providing it. So there was now, by the time I had children, kindergarten was a requirement. But Kirby's birthday is in July 29th. And anyone with a birthday so close to the time school starts has an option. You can say, I don't think he's ready for school yet. Mm. They'll go, okay, see you next year. It's
right.
That easy. If he had already been almost 6, they would have said, no, you better put him in. So, but he wasn't. He was barely 5. So for us to keep him out of school was a freebie. It gave us a very long runway in a way, because we could have the next year either put him in first, put him in kindergarten, or not put him in. Mm. And we knew that the whole year. It's like, okay, well, we have all the options in the world. This year is a gimme. So I got the scope and sequence of the schools to see what they expected kindergarten kids to do. And about that time, my third child was born. So I had two others, and I thought Kirby may want to go back to school. I was not saying you will never see the inside of a classroom as some families do.
Sure, right.
I was saying, yeah, you can stay home. We knew four other unschooling families through a La Leche League playgroup and babysitting co-op that we were in. So again, my life has been kind of a magical education lab. I've just lucked out, like having a cousin my age that I share a room with.
Mm-hmm.
That's lucky. Having been consciously intending to be a teacher as I went through school, that was helpful.
Right.
So I knew four homeschooling families, two unschooling and two curriculum using families. And I knew their kids. And because of the way the babysitting co-op worked, I had seen their kids at my house without their parents. My kids had been to their house without us, and I had seen them with their families because we had a barbecue every month and then a weekly play group or a barbecue or whatever, you know, gathering every month with the dads and all, and then a play group every week. So I knew the families pretty well in a way that most people don't get to see other families. You don't usually get to separate the parents and kids and also see them together. It's either one or the other.
Right, right.
So when we thought about keeping Kirby home, I definitely had no interest in buying a curriculum and starting to play school with him. So I just started paying attention to what the unschoolers are doing and learned it from them and from subscribing to Growing Without Schooling and reading what I could find. And when I looked at the scope and sequence, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, up to third grade, there's really nothing there. It's like balance on a board and, you know, this little really coordination stuff. And
right.
Name the colors, recite the alphabet. So I wasn't worried about it. And also knew from being in school and teaching that there's reading and then there's school reading. And school reading is not real reading. There are readers that are graded. So a second grader will very often say, well, I can read, but I can't read that to something wild at home, you know, a magazine or a newspaper
mm-hmm.
or TV listing. Or now I don't know what kids look at that they need to read menus, internet menus or restaurant menus. But they knew they could read second grade readers. And so I just think that that's a way for schools to I guess I can be cynical on your program, huh? That's a way for that money to keep flowing. That teachers claim we're teaching your child to read, and then they create a situation that mimics the learning to read so that it looks like they can read, so that they can give them a grade. But a lot of it's reading readiness.
Reading in a box kind of too, where they don't want to take that outside and maybe start experimenting with other things they could read. At least that's how I remember feeling about it.
Well, you couldn't read it. And that same teacher, I like Sally Gonzalez, when she was putting us into reading groups, she gave me a reader, you know, whatever, third grade reader, fourth grade reader, read this, showed me the fifth grade reader, read this. And she sort of quizzically reached into her drawer and pulled out a Reader's Digest and pulled it out and gave me something to read. And I read, and I still remember I mispronounced one word, and it was, remember, she's the catechism teacher and I'm the Baptist. The word was holy. And I said, Holly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only word I mispronounced. And she said, you don't know this word? And I said, I don't think I've ever read it. She said, oh, okay. And so I remember that it was unusual for a fourth grader to be able to read from Reader's Digest.
Right.
That's all it took. That one moment she took me afield from how you see if a fourth grader can read. These kids are nine. A lot of nine-year-olds are reading novels.
Sure.
And a lot of nine-year-olds are not reading anything. They're pretending to read. And I remember when there was something to read aloud, some kids would see if they could manage to be fifth or sixth to read it, because then they're just reciting what they heard before. So the teaching of reading in school, I knew, had a bogusness to it. It had a performance to it, so that all the third graders are reading the third grade materials and taking a test, and the teachers are giving them a good grade, maybe an A. You could get an A in reading and not really be fluently reading real anything. You know,
sure.
You can't just.
Right.
So with unschooling, what I started to see, I'm on a tangent as usual. What I started to see was when I said my kids can't read, people said, oh, sure, they can read. And they're trying to justify the little things that they can do. And one person said, well, I consider that my kids are reading because they can tell a McDonald's logo from a Burger King. And I said, but that's like being able to tell a horse from a cow. That's not reading.
Were these the other unschooling families that you were?
Yeah, more beginning unschooling families.
Sure.
People come along and they just have the habit of being supportive.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
And that was the air quotes supportive. Which means telling women, you're an awesome mom. You're the greatest mom. Your kids are lucky to have you. Everything you're doing is perfect, which is a way to have zero progress and zero analytical thought.
Absolutely. Right.
And it's unfortunately common among women, and the internet makes it great because they send those messages with hearts and flowers and sparkles.
With very little investment in the actual people, especially if you're talking about like a Facebook group or a message board. I've seen a lot of that, that sort of automatic support. I mean, that's kind of the function of the group, and it's not so much about real talk or real feedback.
So for all the time that I've ever had discussions, there are some people who have stayed with those for 20 years or more, a few people. I understand people wandering off, but those who have stayed have seen it for years. But we've always said it's not a support group, it's a discussion group. Mm. So if we say, oh, here looks like this could be a problem, or have you tried this, or you might want to back off a while and come at it another way, and then there will be people who just showed up who are going, oh, don't discourage her. No, I'm sure you're doing a great job. I'm sure you're doing the best you can, and you know your child better than anybody, and you know all that stuff. There's a flood of it. I have a collection of it. It's on a page. Any pages that I mention are sandra.com/something, and this one is support. Mm. And it's just a collection of those, because I wish I collected all of them, because after a while it's just kind of ridiculous. But one of the pages has a sad story about a woman who had shot her teens. She wasn't an unschooler, but she got mad at her teens and killed them. And in the article that I read, it said she had talked to her friend the day before about it, and her friend reminded her that they were really good students and nice kids. But I think her friend probably, whatever she said, was supportive. So it
about how she was feeling, right, and not recognizing the crisis.
Right. So I told that story there. So that's a little bit depressing, but so that's an extreme that support can. But on the basic face of it, support can lead to a person not trying to do better. For unschoolers, that's a problem because it's possible to unschool very badly,
right,
and ineffectively, and to just for the parents not to focus on learning, but to focus on freedom, happy quotes and sparkles.
Sure. Let me ask you this, because how does this real honest feedback fit into the unschooling nest environment that you talked about creating with your own family, where obviously optimism and an emotionally supportive environment that fosters natural learning is very important. But if this other type of feedback isn't happening, it invites many of the same problems that we've been talking about here for the last few minutes. So can you, because I think that's a question that a lot of the unschooling parents in my audience would be interested in. And I think it really just comes down to communicating and expressing and clarifying needs and getting needs met both as children and parents. So could you talk a little bit about that?
If you tell someone someone you're actually observing, this was very cool what you just did. That's mm-hmm. honest. But if you blindly say to someone who's using a fake name, you don't even know what country they're from, that they're an awesome mom.
Right.
That's harmful.
Right. Absolutely.
So I think it's a difference between strangers being supportive partly for their own feel good reasons.
Yes.
Because then they feel like a good person. And someone who actually is there, actually trying to help shepherd you or go with you through a difficult time in your life or through a happy time in your life to keep you from screwing up. I don't know how to say that. One example I've used that has been stolen from me by a couple of people, but it's a good example, is to treat your kids, especially when they're really little, like somebody from another country whose cultures are really different from ours. And so if you assume that your child is a fully formed human, they just don't understand the expectations of the day. So right. You might have to coach them about shaking hands and where not to be loud and where to be loud and where to have your shoes on and where not to have your shoes on. All those things they need to learn, but the same way you would with an adult guest, an adult visitor. If somebody comes to New Mexico, I might say, okay, when we get to the restaurant, they're going to say, do you want red or green? And here's what that means.
Right.
Little things that are factors in life for whatever reason, it helps to coach the people on what's expected. Some unschoolers say, we're unschoolers, you can do whatever you want to. And there have been some people who have like taken photos of their kids where the kids shouldn't have been and then go, unschooling. Mm-hmm. Like, who? It's very irritating to me that they're willing to make unschoolers look bad and that they don't really understand the potential or the value of what they could be doing.
Right.
I want to go back to reading, because I saw kids read and learn to read naturally, some of them very young, and I think everybody's known a person or two in their lives who learned to read at two or three, just saw this stuff and figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go to school, and they endure years of reading lessons while they already know how to read. And then some don't figure it out till they're 12 or 13, but they do. At some point, they have all of the maturity and calm and experience, whatever all it takes, because I don't know what all it takes, but some of it's physical and mental maturity to figure that puzzle out on their own, because they do figure it out on their own. Some kid, another of my great lab experiences, when I was in first grade, I was went to school in Texas near my grandmother, and then all the other years I was in New Mexico. We were learning looks say, I think it was called. You outlined the words. And there was also some phonics involved, but it was mostly what the word looks like.
You would say you were learning to read at that age primarily through look say.
Well, in first grade.
Okay.
And I did.
Okay.
I didn't know how to read when I went in, and I knew how to read by the end of the year. Halfway through, they used to sneak me over to the library where first graders weren't allowed to go, and I checked out books a couple of times. I remember the teacher looking both ways down the hallway and going in the library quickly. That was funny. But I learned to read at school. I don't know if I learned to read from school, because having been a teacher now and having hung out with all these unschoolers and having seen my own kids learn to read, when a kid learns to read, it's not because they wanted to. It's not because they worked at it. It's because it came to them. The things started to make sense. So whether one of my kids is the typical left-handed math-ish, engineer-ish kid who in school could easily, they would have said he's dyslexic.
Yeah.
It didn't make any difference to me, because I knew that he was going to figure out how to read in his own way, because so do the kids at school. No matter how many reading experts they give them or how many little reading machines that drag your eyes left to right and stuff, it doesn't matter, because at some point you either figure it out or you get so pissed off at people pushing you and trying and shaming you that you don't learn it. School creates non-readers.
Agreed.
And
yep.
I've never seen unschooling create a non-reader, but I have seen a couple of kids who didn't learn till they were 14 or 15. That's the outside edge. And it wasn't because of anything, because they were not being pressured. It was just because they weren't ready. And when they read, what I was going to say about the comparison between unschooled kids reading and school kids reading is school kids are dragged for years through the reading curriculum, where every year the reading levels – oh, I learned how to figure out the reading levels of books at one point too. You know, to find a passage, it has to do with the length of words, the number of words in a sentence, how complicated are the words. So they purposely weed out anything that's going to be hard to read and give you an easy thing that with only the sounds that you've studied and stuff. But when I moved to New Mexico, it was phonics all the way, absolutely hardcore phonics. So I had both. I had both tools.
Right.
And most people didn't. So I knew that some people can learn easily one way and some people can learn the other way. It makes more sense to them. I don't mean learn to read easily. I mean they take those tools and use them. So every kid who learns to read is going to learn in his own way, no matter what the noise is around him.
So let's talk just for a second about the parent kind of observing this process. A lot of people talk about being a parent in a natural learning environment as a kind of patient experimentation. And I've heard you say in one of your videos, read a little, try a little, wait a little, watch. And I want to talk about that watching process, right? When it comes to like specifically reading, maybe as you were going through this with your own children, what were you watching for?
There's nothing really to watch for except when they can read, they do.
I think a lot of people might feel anxious, like people who haven't gone through this yet. And I've talked to a lot of parents who – and they're aware of this. They admit that they – are processing what's happening with their own children through a kind of schooled mindset. You know what I mean? Like they're still working on this timetable that was put into their head. So it can be a little nerve-wracking. And this is just, you know, from the authentic experiences that I've heard from people, watching and waiting and not knowing when this is going to happen. And the wondering, like, what else could I or unfortunately should I be doing in a situation like this as a parent?
Oh, I see the question better now.
Yeah.
Well, in any case, in any given situation or moment, the parent's choice might be seen as you could screw it up or you could leave it alone.
Hmm.
You could make it worse or you could choose not to make it worse. There may not be a way to make it better. Better might be don't screw it up. And maybe the best analogy for that is not pulling a plant up to see if the roots are growing.
Sure.
You may not be able to get it back in the hole. That's not good for the plant. There are roots you couldn't see that you've just torn off. So anytime they take the kid aside and say, okay, well, we've been unschooling for 3 years, so what do you actually know? Let's have a test. Like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Now you're showing backstage to the kid. Why don't you just go clean up backstage instead? So the deschooling of the parents is the dismantling of their sensibly long-held beliefs that there's something just as natural about semesters and tests and grade levels as the leaves turning in the fall and the moon coming up.
Sure.
But it's not. It is not natural. But because they grew up that way, seeing it in themselves and everybody else, it became natural. And they need to start gradually in themselves sorting out what is construct from what is natural, or they can't have natural learning happen or flourish at their houses if they're still looking at school learning and comparing it to that. It's a lot of work, and that's a bad thing about unschooling. So when anybody's trying to sell unschooling and saying, it's easy, you don't have to do anything, just take your kids out of school.
Right, right.
Oh, it makes me mad, because then those people, that's happened to me twice this week, where somebody learned at somebody else's group some nonsense and came and complained to us. Well, I did all of this, and now my husband and I are fighting and the kids are unhappy and one of them stays up all night. It's like, and I don't want to say, where did you get this bad advice? Because sometimes I already know. But we end up saying, okay, step back a little bit. You jumped too far. You were doing things you didn't understand. You didn't know the why or the idea of it. You did it like it was a new rule, like you replaced the old rules with some new unschooling rules, and that won't work. You need to go with the principles behind it. And that just sounds like so much work to some people. And it is, because if people start to unschool and they don't like it, they can put the kid back in school of some sort, which I was always willing to do with my kids. I didn't get to that part in my story, but I thought maybe Kirby will not be ready for school right away, but the other kids will be. Kirby
right.
was plenty bright. He just wasn't good in groups. He wasn't good at taking direction. In one group he was in, he got frustrated and cried. Another that was a dance class. In an art class he was in, he couldn't wait for the teacher to give the directions. He'd just start grabbing the stuff.
Right.
So that's
yep.
why he didn't go to school. It wasn't that he wasn't receptive to things. It was that he was not going to participate in a group in such a way that the teachers would be impressed with. So that I'd give a year. But I still thought Marty might go, because Marty's kind of a jockish kid and might want the other kids to, you know, run around with, play ball with. And then he didn't go. And then I thought, Holly used to change clothes 3 times a day and make outfits and parade around and say, isn't this pretty? Is this pretty? I thought, Holly's going to want the audience. There's a built-in audience for Holly.
Right.
But each as they came along, I said, do you want to go to school or stay home? For me, that was crucial. That's the pivot point that made it work, because of what I knew about the open classroom failure. I thought, I could do this with unschooling. I could put this on someone who didn't agree to it, who didn't choose it, and it would fail.
Right.
Because it's possible to be as resentful about not being allowed to go to school as being forced to go to school.
Yeah, because it's still a power over relationship, like being made explicit if a parent says you're – and I do hear a lot of people who wind up being unschoolers say this, like they definitely had the choice. You know, obviously we talk a lot about the problem of power over relationships in parenting, where that is very, very clear throughout the entire relationship. There's this other problem that I think you've spoken about a little bit, and I agree it's not good for parents and it's not good for children, that instead of power with, which is what you're talking about, a kind of partnership, there's a mutual powerlessness where kids are placated, they're left to do whatever they want, the parents tell themselves a story about why this totally I don't want to use judgmental language about it more than I already have, I guess, but just this idea that it's totally hands off, whatever happens will happen, and that's kind of magical in itself, where there's this lack of consciousness about it. So I think we're agreeing that power with relationship, that partnership is really what's important here, but it starts with the presentation of a choice.
Yes. And the parents have a choice, because they can put their kids in school. I think it's a bad thing for kids to vilify school. So the name of your project here made me nervous at first, because if parents tell a child, school is horrible, school is the devil, school is hell, you will never see a school as long as you live, and then the parents die in a flaming car wreck and their kids end up going to school.
Yeah.
That'll scare them to death. I always said, school's cool. It's all right. Some people don't like it very much. You don't have to go if you don't want to. If you want to go, you can.
Right.
Which seems to me more honest and healthier, because there can be a family. My mom wasn't as nice to me as my teachers were. She drank and she was resentful and jealous, and she just had some bad personality traits, and it wasn't as good at my house as it was at school. I was at school as much as I could possibly be. If there was another club I could join or anything I could do, marching band, choir, is there any sort of club that I could join where I stay after school? I would. Because I liked the other people. All those things I was attributing to my kids, I think I liked it. I wanted the audience. I wanted the other people to bounce ideas off of. I wanted the social life. And I wanted the library. And I wanted to talk to the teachers who had traveled and who had really cool hobbies at home. My science teacher restored old cars. You know, I would talk to them about whatever they were willing to talk about. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I use school in my own way, for my own purposes. Not everyone can or will do that.
Yeah, and most of my teaching experience was actually with a population of students who had very troubled, distressed kinds of home lives. And it's obviously something that I have to acknowledge, that for many people out there, school can be a kind of respite. The problem, and I think we agree, is that once you walk in the door, choice ends. And if you don't know how to survive that process, it can obviously be quite destructive for a lot of people, whether it's through conformity or rebellion, and not finding the middle ground and not having the perspective as a young person to navigate that successfully. I named the show School Sucks, number one, because, you know, it, 9 years ago, I was much angrier than I am now. I felt lied to. I felt very betrayed. I've thought about renaming it several times. But one—
Is that when you quit teaching? Was that the 9 year mark?
No, I had actually quit teaching in 2006. And then I had gone on to do like college consulting and private tutoring, completely switching populations from, you know, inner city kids who had a lot of emotional challenges from broken homes, and going and working in, you know, the greater Boston area with wealthy overachievers bound for Ivy League schools, helping them write college essays, and recognizing that a lot of the same problems existed as far as the emotional impact of the coercion, that experience. And I think that at the time, working as a tutor with these kids who were captain of the football team, AP level, and just seeing that they had, you know, a general lack of enthusiasm, a general lack of confidence in themselves, an absence of optimism about their future. They just very much appeared to me like they were following tracks kind of unconsciously. And I contrasted that experience with nieces and nephews that I had at the time who were, you know, 5 and 6 years old, and they had this incredible enthusiasm. They believed in themselves. They wanted to show you what they could do. And I kind of, in my analysis, I was like, all right, well, these, you know, these little kids have done nothing. You know, they are just, they know a few jokes. They can do a cartwheel. I'm not saying they've done nothing. They do wonderful things all the time. But I'm saying, like, as far as like what they're told achievements are, they don't have any of that under their belt yet. So what's separating them? What's the difference between these kids who have, finger quotes, achieved, and these little kids who haven't? And it was, you know, 15,000 hours of school in between that had sucked a lot of the natural teaching tools, you know, those innate teaching tools that we have, especially like curiosity and creativity and self-direction. They haven't been broken of that yet, the way these older kids had. So it seemed like an appropriate name. It was also, I feel like, the number one phrase that my own students used to describe their school experience. So
I've heard it myself.
But I totally get what you're saying. Yeah.
You and I could both tell, you know, hours and hours of stories about what sucks about school, and I know that, but I also have seen kids just frightened out of their wits about what if I have to go back to school. Mm. Because sometimes one parent, usually the mom, occasionally the dad, is so attached to the idea of unschooling that she's willing to throw over everything else in her life, including her husband. Right. And then the kids end up in school because a judge said they had to be in school.
Yeah.
And those poor kids are so scared that then they can't function. So I don't think it's worth doing that. And I have seen people other than myself who liked school. Also, to be fair, your rich Boston clients were paying for tutoring.
Yeah.
So they weren't the kids who liked it well enough to bounce up to the top and bounce out.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Or their parents want them to do better, whatever. It could be pressure to get into Harvard. I read years ago, many years ago, that Harvard was ignoring any applications that were 4.0 Eagle Scout, because they all of them were like they had enough of those every year to fill up the whole class.
Indeed. Yeah. The first client I ever had as a tutor, she was a non-traditional Boston College student. She was from South Vietnam, and she was old enough at the time to have actually survived the Viet Cong and fled the country and wound up in the United States. And she was applying to Harvard as a non-traditional student. And I was just working with her on the application process, and her reading and writing skills, her English reading and writing skills were really underdeveloped. And I had a much different attitude, obviously, or less knowledge about Harvard at that time. And I said to the person who's running the company that I work for, I was like, this isn't going to work. She's really like not at the level of academic performance that Harvard's going to require. And she said, no, oh, she's already in. Like, you're going through a formality, right? Because they like the story. That's what they want. And so that obviously opened my eyes to what I think Harvard is actually, and a lot of those Ivy League schools are looking for, because you're absolutely right. They have no shortage of those kinds of applicants. And that was actually another frustration related to this job. I would meet a lot of people who were very, very intelligent, and they were kind of going into this, you know, even at that time, $30,000, $40,000 a year college endeavor very unconsciously, just feeling like it was the 13th grade. And I felt like I was enforcing that pressure on them through my job.
Oh my gosh. So even though you had quit teaching, now you're still serving the schools.
Oh no, I was doing a kind of eulogy for John Taylor Gatto in my last podcast, and I was reflecting on how his work shaped my experience, where I'm encountering, you know, Holt, Kozel, Gatto, all at the time when I'm doing this work, and it's kind of coloring everything that I'm doing and showing it in this new light. And I described my experience at the time as being a public school enforcement officer. If I showed up at your house to work on grades with you, the implicit suggestion was, I'm here because something is wrong with you.
Yeah, and here you're on probation.
yeah.
Not live your other life.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh, that'd be so harsh.
Yeah, it was. And that was eventually what led me to doing this project full time, is I just felt like, you know, through the help of these influences like Holt, like Gatto, like Kozel was a big one, and a handful of others. And then, you know, I started to say, all right, well, who else is criticizing the schools and why? And, you know, I was introduced to what is often called the radical school reform movement of the 1960s and all of those voices and the de-schooling concept. You know, I put together my own mind map that was, you know, philosophically influenced, but also experientially influenced. And that's how I wound up moving forward with this project. But I was very, very lucky to encounter the things I encountered when I did. I wanted to be a high school principal. That was my career track. Is after I taught public school history for a while, I would go and be an administrator, right? Because that's where the money was. And it was also being involved in education in some way. So I'm very grateful that I had the encounters that I did, and it steered me in a different direction. But yeah, the frustration and the questioning I had of what I was doing, it became so palpable that eventually I just kind of had to do something about it.
That reminded me of a reason that I quit. Not that I already was thinking about quitting, but I said I would like to transfer to high school next year because I want to teach some electives. I'm tired of five thing over and over all day. And I was told by people I knew to be half incompetent that I'd known since I was a kid that I was doing very well where I was and that I was more suited for what – so if you do badly, you become an administrator. If you do too well, they stick you there for life. And they said – and I said, well, think about it anyway. I would really like to transfer. And they hired two people from out of district that year to teach at the high school and left me in ninth grade. Mm. And that became the beginning of my last year because I thought these guys don't care what I want. And I have been doing a good job. I was – they were going to, for what it's worth, I was going to be the head of the English department there, and I was the youngest, and they wanted me to be like represent the union and all of that. I wasn't interested in that. I wasn't interested in the politics of it. But even the other teachers respected me, is what I'm trying to say. They weren't like, oh, you're so irritating. They would say your class is kind of loud. Could you keep it down? But that was the complaint. So I wanted to talk about choices really quickly because I know time's almost up.
Sure.
You said what should the parents be doing while they're waiting? Well, they shouldn't be waiting. They should be living a really rich life where input isn't dependent on reading.
Yes.
My youngest read later than the boys did. I expected her to read earlier because she was a girl and had this prejudice or things I had learned reading about how reading works that girls learn earlier, and she just didn't. And so what happened was when she first read, she – read a Judy Blume. I had a guy in Australia say that I was lying.
I said, "You sang the television?"
He said, "Yes, yeah, that TV guy."
Yes.
When I talked to him after that interview, I said, "My daughter learned to read," and I told him this story. Her neighbor, who was homeschooled with a curriculum, had been told by her mother, "You don't want to grow up like Holly Dodd. You need to learn to read." So she gave her a Judy Blume book. I don't remember which one. And it was, "You need to learn, read this book." But the mom wasn't reading it with her. It was just like, "Read a chapter and come and, you know, tell me you read it. Where are you in the book?" So Holly felt bad for this girl because she couldn't go out and play because she was supposed to be reading this book. So Holly asked me to get her copy, and I did. So Holly's letting the girl read it to her because Holly can't read. And the other girl's 10 and Holly's 11, I think. So Holly ends up figuring out how to read from that, from reading along with her and helping her read it. Holly learned to read. The next book she read was Stephen King's The Body, is a novella. But, you know, that's not written at anybody's grade level. And she loved Stand By Me. That was her favorite show since she was a little kid. And so she said, "Isn't that a book, a short story?" I said, "It was longer than a short story." But, yeah, I went and got her a copy that day, brought it back. And she started reading that. So if an 11-year-old can read Stephen King and she couldn't read a few months before, that – at that point, I already knew that this could happen, but that was a really pretty fancy demo at my house because her vocabulary was already really big. So it wasn't like if she was 5 or 6 and saw a big word, she would just be lost. You know, where do I attack this with what little phonics I know?
Right.
This is a word I've never seen before. Drawing an outline around it isn't going to work. Like that Dick and Jane book thing. There are only like 30 words in the whole thing or something. So I was confident by then because I'd seen my boys learn to read, but for Holly to jump Judy Blume, Stephen King, that's the crowning moment. I don't need to worry about it anymore. But so for parents who think that there should be intermediate steps, that's a good story. Maybe there aren't intermediate steps. Maybe I learned to read when I was 6 because I was ready to learn to read. And the fact that people around me were reciting phonics rules and we were reading through in our classroom these Dick and Jane books, maybe that's not what caused me to read.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe, like Holly seeing her friend make mistakes, maybe me seeing the other kids attack a word badly helped me see how not to read.
Right, right.
So I don't know, because I wasn't yet that analytical, but I don't think that teaching a child to read is going to help. I think it's going to make them afraid and make them frustrated, because if they can't, they can't, period, whether they're in school or they're home. And so it's not anything that anybody can do. And then some people will come into a discussion and say, when they really want to learn to read, they will. No, if they really want to learn to read and they're not ready, distract them. Movies, share movies with them, share music, and don't not like write out the song lyrics and make them read along. Nothing like that. Nothing scholarly, you know, nothing that looks like school. When the parents are still trying to make unschooling look like school, that's because the parents haven't deschooled. Before I ever came to homeschooling, somebody somewhere had said deschooling takes a month for every year you've been in school. I'd still never have heard where that first came from. And it wasn't even about unschooling. It was about any kind of school, any kind of homeschooling. And so I thought, well, why would there be a claim like that? But I've never seen it fail.
Right.
That's what it takes.
It's interesting. Another thing that I really like that I heard you say in another one of your videos was somebody asked you just about the whole unschooling enterprise. How long does it, how much time does this take? I think was the question. And the answer was something like, it takes all the time and none of the time.
Pam Sarushian and I were both there and I think she said none. How much time do you have to spend every day on this? She said none. I said all. And that's what it is. You change your life. You change the way you see and believe and interact.
But it's also, with respect to deschooling, it's the contrast between what people, the expectations that people might bring versus what natural learning is, right? If you're asking me about natural learning, I might say, then yeah, it's all of your time. If you're talking to me about schooling and your schooling-related expectations or your schooled expectations, then it's none of your time. That's
exactly.
Over.
That's it. And so when we talk about choices, when I say you don't have to, and people are coming into the new discussion, they go, well, you have to do this, or I had to do that. I stop them and I give them a link to my page on have to, sanderdodd.com/have to. It's because if you feel like you have to do something, you've just made yourself powerless unnecessarily. Don't do that. For one thing, you don't move from that imagined have to.
Right.
And for another thing, you get in the habit of saying have to, you're going to pass it around. You're going to tell your kids what they have to do too. And if they don't have a choice, they can't make a choice. And when people say, well, he chose to be an Olympic swimmer when he was seven. It's like no kid ever chose to be an Olympic swimmer when he was seven. But some people will come up with something like that. Well, he said he wants to be a pilot. She said she's interested in this. Okay, let that interest last for about a minute or a lifetime, but don't own it. Don't take it over. And if the parents say, I want to unschool and I want to do it and I'm never going to change my mind, that's not as healthy as saying, I'm going to try this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I'm talking about making choices, I don't mean make a choice for the rest of your life. Even with a marriage, you choose to marry somebody and you make oaths in front of people. That's not going to last you 40 years. You have to decide a couple or five times a day to be nice, to stick around, to help that person, to listen to them. And so it's the same with unschooling too. If you're going to have a good relationship with another person, with your partner, with your child, with the neighbors, with the other unschoolers, you need to choose over and over and over as often as you can. Maybe people aren't going to make three conscious choices a day, but if they're really good at it and they're in the flow and they have a bunch of little kids, they can get up to 40 conscious choices a day. I don't think anybody's ever counted them, but you know what I mean.
Right, absolutely.
One conscious choice to be a kind parent forever isn't going to get you past the next morning. You're going to get tired and irritated. But if every time you start to do something, you try to remember that you do have a choice, you don't have to do this, then the choices can ratchet up gradually to a place that you never knew you could even get to, as to patience and understanding and an acceptance of how learning works. But it does, you can't jump 15 steps all at once. You have to walk there yourself. So you might start with choices that sound horrible, like I could send them to school or I could buy a curriculum. Okay, well, buy the curriculum. That doesn't mean you have to use it. Just because you bought a curriculum doesn't mean that you're obligated to do 180 days of school at home at the table.
Right.
So if people make choices all along, then they can walk away from the things that were harmful to them as children or that might be harmful to their children now. They can walk one step at a time towards something better as they gradually, from read a little, try a little, wait a while, watch, start to see what does seem to them better.
Right. And it's a great way to promote conscious living. The absence of choice really invites apathy, where the abundance of choice is kind of a shield against the development of that apathy. Like in school, I felt like it was always implicit, but it was consistent. Obey and conform, you know, like fit in, fit this mold. And the result of that, for me anyway, and I understand everybody's experience is different, but it was a kind of apathy where I became an adult. And in that state, I said, well, who's going to author this life? You know, not me, you know, because I had never had the availability of choices in so many aspects of life. But I have seen that contrast with unschoolers or people who really embrace this idea that you're talking about. They very much see themselves as authoring their own story. And, you know, that is one of the most important things that I'm promoting with my work. And it sounds like you're doing something similar.
I don't know. That doesn't sound like me.
No.
No, I don't. I think living in the moment is more my style than authoring your own story. But I may be misunderstanding what you're envisioning with your phrase too. But I don't think that deciding what you want to do in advance and then feeling that you have to do that is as useful as living in a sort of alert and open way with what happens the next day and the next moment.
I think the two are totally related. I mean, not to torture the metaphor, but you do have to kind of author your own story one line at a time. You know?
Okay, I'll go with it then.
Yeah, that is that conscious living and being in the moment, sure.
There's a joke about stuntmen and circuses and stuff where they say, kids, don't try this at home.
Mm-hmm.
There are things about school that parents should not try at home.
Right. Right. That was one of John Holt's most powerful warnings, I think. Yeah, I forget what he called it. Maybe he just said, don't make your home a miniature school or something
yes.
like that.
Right? Yes. Yes. That's a good quote. I like that. So another thing about John Holt I just want to throw in here
sure.
because I was a huge John Holt fan when I first started this. That's what I would read for inspiration is John Holt books.
Mm.
Then as my kids got older and I saw myself and some of the other people that I hung around with a lot, Joyce Federal, Pam Sarushian, some other ones, Deb Lewis, as we tried this stuff out, we learned things that John Holt didn't have the ability to do, to see, to get to. Because when he traveled, he stayed with families, but he was always a visitor.
Right.
And it's like the principle of an experiment affecting the data.
Absolutely, yep.
How is a kid going to act when John Holt's visiting? Well, you know, not the way he acts when John Holt's not visiting. To whatever extent, we don't know and it doesn't matter. He never was a parent. And so he didn't have to get up in the middle of the night with anybody. It was school with him and theory with him. And I'm very, very grateful that he did learning without schooling, because he had the time and energy and interest to connect these people together. A lot of unschoolers still then especially, and still now, don't take it beyond academics. And for me, to separate life from academics misses like 90% of the learning that happens when you don't divide the world into subject areas.
Yeah.
When people are new, they're consciously going to be looking at that, like they'll do something and go, oh my gosh. And I've mentioned a few things already here about when I was teaching. That was science and history and language. It's like, okay. After you do that for a year or two and you're categorizing things as they happen, after a while you can stop doing that because you become confident enough that everything will touch on everything eventually, that every single thing, every thought, every object connects to 2 or 10 other things. And pretty soon you realize that you're living in this web and this grid of connections, and that whatever you do, whatever happens tomorrow, will be part of your own story, but you don't need to know where it's going to go. Just be the best, most joyful, most open you that you can be, healthy, happy, learning, and it won't slide backwards. You won't fall out of that. It'll hold you up. Well, I've never said this before, so I ran out of words. It'll like buoy you up in that learning environment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no hole to fall out of.
Right. Absolutely. I remember in, I think it was Class Dismissed, you were interviewed for that documentary. And I remember being quite like struck by this statement that you made, that you didn't like the word education. And then I kind of thought about it. You know, like one of the most important things that I try to do is make explicit the difference between schooling and education on my show. But I got the sense that you felt like education makes it the word itself like an education, right? So now it becomes this noun that is like self-contained. It's defined. It's limited, especially when you consider how most people think about education. Did you get an education?
Right.
Where did you get your education?
It has a start and a finish. It has edges.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. It also is something that was predefined. It was something that existed that then you went and got.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I really like that reframing of it. I think that's really valuable. And I think that would be a nice place to end. I really, really enjoyed the conversation, Sandra, and I was hoping you could just tell my audience a little bit about where they could find more of your work, audio, video, articles, and books.
My books are being re-released later this year, early next year, new editions by Pamela Riccia. So don't get a book yet, or I don't know, you can. I have two books, The Big Book of Unschooling and Moving a Puddle, which Moving a Puddle is a collection of all of the published essays up to 2005. And so some of those are pre-internet and from when my kids were little, which can be interesting all in itself and has a lot of photos in it. If you get the ebook from Lulu, the photos are in color too. But just to find anything of mine, go to sandradodd.com, and there are links to other things. You can also go to the, you can put sandradodd.com and then type garbage, and then you'll get a search box. You can look things up. Uh-huh. There are, I thought I had over 2,000 pages of unschooling information, and when I last talked to my provider about my site, they said there are over 6,000 HTML pages.
Oh, wow.
Some of those are not about unschooling. So that must be 5,000 pages or so. It's a lot. And by page, you know what I mean. Like some of them, if you print out, it'd be 10. So I've just been collecting and adding to this collection as people wrote wonderful things, I save them. And so there's a ton of stuff there. Nobody will ever find it all or read it all. And I don't expect anybody to even try. But my point is going to be whatever you're looking for might be in there. And if not, find a discussion that I'm in and ask, and we will build you something.
That is terrific. Well, it's long overdue that I had you on the show. You've been on my list of guests that I was excited about for a long time. And I know at this point you are a world-renowned unschooling advocate. So I definitely appreciate your time. And I appreciate you taking a chance with a show called School Sucks. And I'm very happy with how it went. So thank you so much.
Thank you. There are so many paths on the mountain.
is still the same. Yeah, yeah.